Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get to the show, I want to thank you for being here with us. It is not easy out there right now. Much of the news is really tough and a lot of uncertainty around us. But one thing that is certain is the world. We're going to keep bringing you critical reporting on international events, keep highlighting the voices and people at the center of these stories. And we're able to keep doing this because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 30th, we're in fundraising mode. We need to raise $25,000 before the end of the month. If you believe, as we do, in independent, fact-based journalism and in its power to make sense out of the noise and help preserve democracy around the globe, I hope you'll support our work financially. Please make your gift today at theworld.org/give or check out the link in the episode notes. Every gift helps us get closer to our goal. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you, and now the show.
Mired in war and scrambling for an exit plan in Ukraine.
We run a risk of a kind of a real catastrophic success here.
What would an end to the Russian invasion look like? I'm Carol Hills. Also in Ukraine, doctors want to know how to help in case of a chemical weapons attack. Syrian doctors can speak from experience.
Many experts provide the training based on theoretical knowledge, but only Syrians have practical knowledge.
And El Salvador's government is leaning hard into Bitcoin. This clothing seller is required to accept it.
No había un preámbulo de capacitación,
but says she was never trained on how to use it. And critics say the government is gambling the country's welfare in a virtual casino. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. This week, British Columbia got approval from the Canadian government for an experiment of sorts. Starting next year, it will be the first place in Canada to decriminalize drugs, including opioids, cocaine, and ecstasy. It's an attempt to reverse the region's spiraling overdose crisis. The World's Alana Gordon starts us off today.
Like the United States, Canada has been experiencing record numbers of overdose deaths. British Columbia and Vancouver especially have been a center of the crisis. Kennedy Stewart is Vancouver's mayor. He says he experiences this up close each and every day.
You know, I got an email this Monday, and it was 9 people had died out of our city of 700,000 people. The week before that, it was 12. The week before that, it was 10. And every week, our firefighters are saving between 150 and 200 people.
A lot of the surge has to do with an illicit drug supply that's become more and more toxic. A super potent opioid, fentanyl, has upped the risks of accidentally overdosing. The pandemic has also weakened social supports and connections, making the situation even more acute. For Stewart, those regular emails and updated stats of people who died are poignant. But a year and a half ago, it got personal.
Until one email included a family member who had died. And that, I just think about that every day. It's hard to say this, but I mean, she ended up dying alone on a sidewalk under an awning in the pouring rain at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and firefighters couldn't revive her.
Stewart says another family member has overdosed multiple times and is struggling a lot physically and mentally. To address the massive crisis, the province has put all hands on deck, expanding treatment, even experimenting with prescribing people pharmaceutical alternatives to street drugs. This was the backdrop last year when the province requested a change in policy in a big way to decriminalize drugs so people won't face arrest if they're found with small amounts of illegal drugs like cocaine or heroin. Doing so requires an exemption from federal laws. Yesterday,
I am here to announce that I will be granting British Columbia's exemption request. As of
Caroline Bennett, Canada's Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, gave BC the green light.
Adults 18 and over in British Columbia will no longer be subject to criminal charges for the possession of up to 2.5 grams of certain illegal drugs for personal use, and the drugs will not be confiscated.
Vancouver's Stewart says he nearly cried at the announcement. He says decriminalizing drugs doesn't encourage or enable use, and that police support the change. That's because, he says, it's important to focus on addressing the underlying needs of problematic drug use.
This is not a glamorous lifestyle, right? This isn't like you're some kind of high school kid that decides, oh, I'm gonna start injecting fentanyl for no reason. Most of this drug use is from trauma. That's why we want to get away from putting people in handcuffs and getting them to health care.
And he says take away that stigma and shame that can prevent people from reaching out. British Columbia joins a handful of places around the world in decriminalizing drugs in some form, including Oregon in the U.S. and Portugal in Europe. But reactions to the new policy in Canada have been mixed. Some say people need to be able to carry a larger amount of drugs without facing arrest, and that it doesn't go far enough to address an increasingly deadly drug supply. The policy also faces pushback in parts of Canada. Alberta's premier stated that the change is counterproductive to addressing addiction. This move in British Columbia is a three-year experiment that leaders say they'll be closely monitoring once it kicks in early next year. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine, support has poured into the country from around the world. Body armor, money and weapons, foreign volunteers who've taken up arms against Russian troops. Now a group of Syrian and American physicians are there to train Ukrainian medical workers to prepare for a possible chemical weapons attack. The Real Shirin Jafari has a story.
To be clear, so far there is no official confirmation of any chemical attack in Ukraine. There were reports of a suspected case back in April in the city of Mariupol, but that is not confirmed as well. Dr. Zahir Sahlul heads a medical and humanitarian NGO called Med Global. When he first went into Ukraine earlier this year to train medical workers, he was surprised when they asked him about how to respond to a chemical attack.
All of them were interested to know more about how to be prepared for chemical weapons, which was surprising for me. I mean, I was reading some of the reports about the prospects of using of chemical agents by the Russians, but I didn't expect Ukrainians to be that concerned, but they were.
They wanted to know what protective equipment they needed, what medications might be used as antidotes, and what the best practices are to keep medical staff safe while saving victims. Sahlul developed a series of training sessions focused on answering these questions. This is from a training video he shared with me. Sahlul is giving a presentation and a Ukrainian woman translates. Rows of medical workers in their white lab coats are listening intently. A few crane their necks to get a better look at one of their colleagues trying on a hazmat suit in front of the auditorium. In another session, this one conducted over Zoom, a chemical weapons expert in Florida explains different types of deadly agents to a group of physicians in Ukraine.
Choking agents, that would be like chlorine, their blister agents, mustard gas, the nerve agents, which will be our focus today.
One of the doctors attending these trainings was Oris Leshnevsky, a pediatric surgeon in Lviv, Ukraine. I asked him why Ukrainian medical workers feel an urgent need to be trained for possible chemical attacks.
Well, you know, till the 24 February, no one even imagine in the world that neighbor country will invade its friendly nations. Can we be worried about using chemical weapons? Yes, yes, we are worried about that because we don't know what Russia will do next.
Leshnevsky says he didn't learn much about chemical attacks in medical school, but the training sessions have helped him get a better understanding. Zahir Sahlul, the head of Med Global, is Syrian-American. He says Syrian physicians have developed real-world skills for dealing with chemical attacks. The estimated number of chemical attacks in Syria is more than 300 since the start of the war. The United Nations and the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons investigated some of these incidents and concluded that the government of Bashar al-Assad was responsible. Sahlul tells me about one of his colleagues, an anesthesiologist in charge of a small hospital outside of Damascus. In August 2013, the area came under chemical attack.
And within a couple of hours, he had 700 plus patients, all of them suffocating, all of them had twitches and convulsions.
He was the lone physician in that hospital and had to make split-second decisions, Sahlul says, about who to save and who to let go. Despite his best efforts, he couldn't save everyone.
And by the morning, he had more than 144 deaths. Two-thirds of them are children. I would say that we accumulated a lot of knowledge on chemical agents painfully in Syria. Many experts who provide the training, they provide the training based on theoretical knowledge and things like that, but only Syrians have practical knowledge.
Sahlul sees a lot of similarities between the tactics that Russia used in Syria and the ones it's using in Ukraine. The targeting of medical facilities, disregard for civilian life, and the undermining of international law. One thing that Sahlul emphasizes during his training sessions is that the medical workers must protect themselves as well as their patients.
Because if you lose a physician or a nurse, it's very difficult to replace, especially in a war situation where you have already shortage of healthcare workers.
Another painful lesson he learned from the war in his own country. Sahlul and his team will continue to provide training and support in Ukraine, he says. And Orest Leshnevsky, the surgeon in Lviv, tells me he keeps his chemical mask and protective gear nearby at all times. He prays that he will never have to use them. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafori.
Gas prices are surging this summer, and the German government has a simple message for residents and visitors. Ditch your cars and take the train. All summer, you can buy a rail pass good for 1 month of unlimited local and regional train travel in Germany for just 9 euros, which is about 10 bucks. With us to discuss this further is John Wirth. He's a British resident of Berlin and a founder at the Trains for Europe campaign. John, as a train enthusiast and campaigner, what do you think of this new discounted train ticket?
I think this is a tremendous opportunity. It will allow a whole new generation of people to take the train, to realize what you can reach by train, and to potentially make the change from driving for those sorts of trips and to take public transport instead. I'm very optimistic about what the German government has done here.
Now, this is, of course, meant to help people out in the midst of rising gas prices. In some parts of the world, including some U.S. states, the government has dropped gas taxes for the same reason. How did the German government land on this particular policy move?
It was actually a political compromise. In the German government, there are two parties that are kind of at loggerheads about how to best reduce this burden on people. The liberals that want to reduce the cost of petrol at the pumps for car drivers, and the Greens that want to reduce public transport costs. So what has happened here is Germany has actually done both of those things. It's reduced petrol taxes and it's reduced public transport costs. So that's how this 9 euro ticket came about. What will happen essentially is all of the local public transport authorities in the individual cities or different regions will basically total up the difference between these special reduced months and their regular months, and the federal government will then finance that shortfall.
Germany has a strong car culture. Do you think this will really get people out of their cars and into train seats?
That's really the big question that we don't really know yet. The argument is, is this actually going to change behavior? Or instead, because it makes trips so cheap, it will just mean that people make more train trips and to places they otherwise wouldn't go. So that's the kind of big question. We don't really know the answer to that yet.
What about potential overcrowding on trains during this experiment? Is there going to be any increased capacity?
A couple of regions have already said they will add some extra trains in order to deal with the predicted increase in the number of passengers, particularly at weekends. But passenger experts are saying that is not going to be enough in order to manage to deal with potential overcrowding. And there is also the concern as well, particularly that you're allowed to take your bicycle with you on regional trains in Germany as well. And so a lot of people are fearful that on weekends, a lot of people all try and take their bicycles on the trains, profit from the cheap tickets, and suddenly trains will be delayed as a result of this overcrowding. So yes, there is potentially that danger as well. And German railways in general have suffered already for a few decades of underinvestment. Capacity has not kept up with the demand.
This 9 euro ticket offer is good for non-Germans, isn't it? Really anyone?
Anyone can buy it. All you have to do is go to a ticket machine upon your arrival in Germany or download a app of the public transport authority of the place that you're going to be visiting and buy it online. The ticket is valid for a calendar month, so you just need one for June, July, and August. Anyone can buy them, no questions asked.
So, John, where do you plan on going with your 9 euro ticket?
I'm going to go to the cities of Görlitz and Zittau because it would normally cost me about 40 euros return to go to either of those cities from Berlin. But now I can do it for 9 euros. And so that's where I'm going to be going. And indeed, those are exactly the sorts of trips which for me are going to be possible now.
John Wirth is a British resident of Berlin and a founder at the Trains for Europe campaign. Thanks so much, John, and happy traveling.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. Mexico this week saw the strongest hurricane ever to hit the country during the month of May. Agatha, a Category 2 hurricane, pummeled the country's southern Pacific coast, killing at least 10 people. From Mexico, Michael Fox reports that the Atlantic hurricane season, which starts today, is expected to be more active than usual.
About a month ago, my family and I visited Huatulco National Park along Mexico's Oaxacan coast. Warm, crystal clear water. Fish everywhere. That's us snorkeling with friends. It was dry and hot, no rain in sight. But this week, torrential rains and sustained winds over 100 miles an hour ripped through that same region as Hurricane Agatha made landfall on Monday as a Category 2 gale. Mudslides hit at least two highways, and electricity was knocked from many communities. It rained really hard on Monday morning, says Carlos Sanchez, who runs a community radio station in the municipality of Juchitán, a couple of hours up the Oaxacan coast. There were serious floods in homes in lower-lying areas, he says. Videos shared over social media show buildings destroyed, roads out, and homes flooded with pools of water, residents working to keep things dry while the rain pelts outside. Hurricane Agatha has been downgraded into a tropical depression, but it's still expected to bring heavy rains to the Yucatan Peninsula this week. It's also possible it may reform as a new storm in the Caribbean in the coming days, heading east toward Florida. Jill Trepanier is a hurricane specialist at Louisiana State University.
It is unique. It is rare that we would see a storm form this early and intensify as quickly as it did, but it's par for the course that we've been on in the last few years because we're seeing rapid intensification.
Trepanier says there is one key factor driving the hurricane's ability to get big fast: sea temperatures. They've been on the rise for decades. Now, of course, sea temperatures also fluctuate due to a number of factors, including weather phenomena like La Niña, which brings warmer water to the Atlantic and the Caribbean. Trepanier says that's the case this year.
The temperature right now in the Gulf of Mexico, the Caribbean predominantly, it's about half a degree to 2 degrees Celsius warmer than normal. But then if you look at ocean temperature near, say, the eastern seaboard, like New Jersey, the Carolinas, New York, right now, it's about 4 degrees warmer than normal Celsius, right? So if a storm happens to make it up into that part, it's going to intensify quickly.
In Fahrenheit, that's like 7 degrees higher. Mexican meteorologist Jose Martin Cortez says we need to be ready. He says all of the forecasts show that we're going to have above normal tropical activity, a very active hurricane season. If it is another above average year, it would be the seventh in a row. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported last week that we can expect as many as 10 Atlantic hurricanes this year, and half of them major ones. If there is one silver lining, Hurricane Agatha, although devastating, finally brought much-needed rain to some areas of Mexico that have been battling drought. The same will be the case for future storms. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Quintana Roo, Mexico.
In El Salvador, the government made an unusual economic decision last September. It adopted Bitcoin as legal currency and mandated that all businesses must accept it for payment. Since then, the crypto market has lost billions of dollars. But El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, is doubling down on Bitcoin. And many believe this is extremely risky for one of Latin America's poorest countries. The World's Tibi Saicea reports.
On the Pacific coast of El Salvador, about an hour from the capital, there is a town called El Zonte. Warm water, volcanic sand, and perfect waves for surfing attract tourists from all over. El Zonte is also one of the first places in the world where you can use digital coins to pay for just about anything, from coffee to a hotel room or a prepaid phone card. And that seems to be a big tourist attraction too, says Mama Rosa. She owns a small restaurant in the area. She told me her business was the first one in El Zonte to accept payments in Bitcoin. So now this grandmother who cooks with firewood does business with her digital wallet. Mama Rosa says she used her Bitcoin savings to buy two dairy cows. Since El Salvador adopted Bitcoin as a legal currency, it's mandatory for all local businesses to accept it. And it's been very popular in El Zonte. But the reality looks very different in most of the country, where no one seems to be using cryptocurrency, says Maria Pinzon. She sells women's clothes in San Salvador, the capital.
No había un preámbulo de capacitación, por ejemplo, de formación en tema al dinero electrónico.
There was never any training on how to use digital money, she says. We had no idea how it worked. President Bukele's government rolled out a digital crypto wallet called Chivo. That's Salvadorian slang for cool. It came preloaded with $30 of Bitcoin to encourage people to use it. But Pinzon says the app doesn't always work.
Un par de veces sí tuvimos como problema, ¿verdad? Porque no nos caía el pago.
We've had problems with the app, she says, and one time we didn't get any payment. So Pinzon says she stopped using it.
¿Cómo va a obtener ganancias si...
She also has a question for President Bukele. How are we supposed to earn money with Bitcoin if its value is plunging? Many Salvadorians are skeptical about the decision to make Bitcoin legal currency.
This is like a gamble with the welfare of the people in a kind of virtual casino.
Ricardo Castaneda is an economist with the Center for Fiscal Studies in Central America. Here he is again, switching to Spanish.
Dijeron que iban a comprar más Bitcoin. Sin ningún estudio técnico, sin ningún tipo de...
There was no serious research behind the decision, Castaneda says. It was a very risky move. He says President Bukele was hoping to influence the Bitcoin market, but that never happened. What did happen, Castaneda says, is the country's treasury lost as much as $36 million in a matter of weeks.
Pero para el caso de El Salvador, representa casi la mitad del Ministerio de Agricultura.
That's the same as half of the annual budget of the Ministry of Agriculture, he says, which helps Salvadorians who face food insecurity. According to Castaneda, El Salvador has real money problems and Bitcoin is making them worse. President Bukele asked the International Monetary Fund for a loan, but the IMF refused because of the government's Bitcoin binge. Bukele is not backing down, though. Last month, he announced another purchase of 500 Bitcoin. And ads like this are running on national television. The public service announcement encourages people to use Bitcoin. And President Nayib Bukele, who wears baseball caps and calls himself the world's coolest dictator, insists that Bitcoin will provide a path for financial freedom in El Salvador. Now he wants to borrow $1 billion to build Bitcoin City, a tax-free zone located at the base of a dormant volcano. For the world, I am Tibisay Sea.
A big new railway is being built on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Part of it runs over caves environmentalists say must be protected.
We are talking about thousands of kilometers of interconnected underground rivers.
A judge has halted construction there for now, but the fight isn't over. That story and Istanbul's growing ranks of women cabbies coming up. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. As the Russian invasion of Ukraine approaches its 100th day, an off-ramp to the conflict appears nowhere in sight. An effort in recent weeks by Italian officials to float a four-point peace plan fell flat. Both Ukrainian and Russian officials have dismissed the plan, but any endgame for the conflict will likely include elements of the proposal. To hear more about it and what an end to this war might look like, we reached out to Mark Hanna. He's a senior fellow at the Eurasia Group Foundation. He joins us from Rome, where he recently participated in discussions about the Russian invasion at the NATO Defense College. Mark, what was Italy's four-point plan to end the war?
Italy was interested in talking about Ukraine's international status, whether Ukraine will retain its territorial integrity, its sovereignty, its autonomy, but also whether it's neutral and gives up its bid for NATO membership.
In Italy's four-point plan, does it require Ukraine to cede any territory?
It requires Ukraine to talk about it. And for better or worse, President Zelensky has, at least in public, stubbornly stuck to this position that there will not be a millimeter of Ukrainian territory that is ceded to Russia. I think as the war continues to grind on, there might be a recalculation when Zelensky and Ukraine realizes that the West's support for its defense is finite and ultimately conditional.
A Russian official called Italy's plan a fantasy. What sort of reception did it receive in discussions there in Rome at the NATO Defense College?
I can't talk about who said what, but let me put it this way. The Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, essentially said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that you don't arm our adversary with one hand and then reach out with a peace treaty or a peace plan with another hand. I'd just push back on that and suggest that might be exactly what the West should do or is doing in order to create leverage for Ukraine as it moves toward a negotiated settlement.
This week, the White House announced that mid-range rockets that could reach Russia would be part of the $700 million arms package to Ukraine. What do you think of that decision?
It could be dangerous if President Zelensky, in the fog of war, decides that he wants to use these weapons for something other than defensive, if he wants to start going after Russian targets that aren't within Ukraine's borders. And let's not forget that it's not just the president of Ukraine whose word we are relying on here, but also the service members in the Ukrainian military. These are sophisticated weapons that are computer guided. Oftentimes they take up to 6 months to train people on using them. I think it's been reported that they're going to truncate this training down to 1 week out in Poland and in Germany. So the Ukrainian military might not be well trained with these very sophisticated weapons. And in the fog of war, you might get one soldier or overeager service member who decides to fire them over Russia's borders. And in the fog of war, that could be perceived as escalatory by Russia and its friends in this conflict.
Mark, when it comes to weapons being supplied by the U.S. and those weapons being capable of being fired into Russia, is the issue that they're American weapons that might be used inside Russian territories, or is it about reaching Russian territory itself that's the problem?
Ukraine doesn't have a lot of homemade weapons that it's using right now. It's relying heavily on the patronage and the patience of the West and the weapons that the West is providing it. That doesn't take away any agency Ukraine has. And in his recent op-ed in the New York Times, the president did say, you know, nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. So we are giving these weapons to Ukraine because they have been requested by President Zelensky. But I do worry that a bottomless and of unconditional support could artificially inflate Ukraine's sense of what it might be able to achieve. It also takes away the incentive for concessions or a negotiated diplomatic agreement.
I want to push back a bit on the whole notion of concessions. Why should Ukraine offer any concessions? They were attacked, unprovoked. Why should they concede anything?
That's a very good question. I think that whether a country should or shouldn't is not so much a moral question. It's about the kind of strategic environment that Ukraine finds itself in and whether it's advantageous to Ukraine and its citizens and its security and its prosperity to end the war. We run a risk of a kind of a real catastrophic success here. The U.S. wants Russia to lose, but not so badly that it will resort to nuclear weapons. So there is a way in which, by not providing other types of defense and security cooperation, the presence of American troops, for example, that we are limiting our involvement. Now, as long as the West's involvement is limited, Ukraine is not going to necessarily kick Russia out of Crimea, right? Russia has a long-standing claim, whether it's valid or not, legitimate or not. I don't see as a realistic end state here that Russia is booted from Crimea. So ultimately, what Ukraine does or does not do is up to that country, but it needs to be given assurances from friendly countries like the United States about what we will do. But it also needs to be given caveats and warnings and disclaimers about what we're not willing to do, and then make a rational decision based on its strategic environment, what it is able to do. In a perfect world, Ukraine would come out of this with the pre-February 24th borders, with its territorial integrity intact and with no concessions. Whether or not it should make concessions really is up to the duly elected government of Ukraine.
Do you think President Biden, in his op-ed in the New York Times this week, do you think he was crystal clear about what the U.S. is not willing to do in Ukraine?
On some points, yes. On some points, no. I think he needs to be very clear that while Ukraine has agency, and he did say nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, he's not going to pressure the Ukrainian government in private or in public, I'm reading his words here, to make any territorial concessions. But I wouldn't be surprised if behind the scenes, the United States is relying on its own agency. It can't abandon the agency that it has as a very geopolitically powerful country. And there are many ways in which a negotiated settlement might be in the vital interests of the United States. There might be many ways in which the longer this drags on, you know, the prospect of a failed state in Russia, a country that has the world's largest nuclear arsenal, is not something the United States should be sanguine about. So there are ways in which you can support the agency of a country like Ukraine while at the same time asserting your own agency. You can be clear about how you can help Ukraine make decisions, and you can advocate for Ukraine's interest without subverting America's national interest to Ukraine's interests here.
Mark Hanna is in Rome, where he's a senior fellow at the Eurasia Group Foundation. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Carol.
This next story involves two brutal murders with repercussions felt in two parts of the world. Two sisters who lived in Spain were strangled and shot dead in their native Pakistan last week. Six relatives in Pakistan, all men, have been arrested. The victims were allegedly forced to marry years before and wanted divorces. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona, where the Spanish-Pakistani community is working to try and prevent forced marriages and domestic violence.
At a Pakistani women's center downtown, 44-year-old Jasmine Real stares at a photo of the murdered sisters. I ask her what's going through her mind.
Pena, tristeza, cosas cruel.
Pain, sadness, she says. What their family did was so cruel. Those women were free to choose their own destiny. I have a 20-year-old daughter, she says, and I would never do that. The murders have shaken the large Pakistani community here in Spain. In Barcelona alone, the population's around 200,000. For Real, who's both Spanish and Pakistani, the tragedy touches a deep nerve. I was 16 when my parents tricked me into going to Pakistan, she says. My father took my passport and held me captive there for 2.5 years. He told me I couldn't leave until I married. She finally married a cousin she'd never seen before. She calls it the day of her disgrace. I gave in, she says. I had to spend another 9 months with my in-laws. When we finally returned to Spain, I realized I was pregnant. Real had two kids with her husband, who she says beat and abused her. She told her parents she wanted to divorce, but they forbade it. They didn't look kindly on the idea. Good or bad, they said, he's your husband. You have to put up with him. So Real came here to the Pakistani Women's Group for help. The center's founder, Uma Jamshid, walked her through the proceedings.
So this is a very sad and brutal part of the culture, and we must transform a new culture with the acceptance, equal right for women and men.
Jamshid says in traditional Pakistani culture, women are not in control of their own lives. She says you can also see that here in Europe. Every day, she says, one or two young Pakistani women come through her door. They ask for help to either avoid a forced marriage, to get out of one, or just to break free from controlling male relatives, like this young woman who comes here for language classes.
I'm from Pakistan, and I'm here in Spain from last 2 years.
Tabassum came here to study medicine, but says her three brothers-in-law in Barcelona are trying to stop her.
They sent me to remain in home, not go outside, in the parks, in the markets. Even I have not permission to learn the language.
These are the stories that anger and inspire Huma Jamshid. But rather than try to change the male mindset, she's empowering women.
I am giving tools to all girls to learn skills, learn local languages, and to speak out whenever any aggression.
She encourages them to speak with social workers, teachers, and as a last resort,
go to the police station and file the complaint.
In Girona, about an hour north of Barcelona, a special police unit has investigated 200 cases of alleged forced marriages since 2009. This is Subinspector Rosa Negra.
Un cas que teníem, doncs, la picaven amb un cable de televisió, una nena de 13 anys.
One case we had, she says, was a mother who beat her 13-year-old daughter with a television cable. We had her placed in protective services. They said it was just domestic violence, but we suspected it was linked to the girl having rejected a cousin her parents wanted her to marry. The police couldn't prove it, but that marriage never happened. Negra says law enforcement alone can't protect these women. Officers work with social services, even with Spanish embassies overseas to inform women of their rights. Jasmin Real, the divorced mother of two, says her life might have been different if she'd known help was out there.
Sí, hoy en día tengo rencor a mi padre, duro, pero...
To this day, I still resent my father, she says. I was at the prime of my life, had my whole future ahead of me. I've been alone since, she says. I never rebuilt my life. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Mexico's Mayan Train is a nearly 1,000-mile-long railway being built on the Yucatan Peninsula. It's designed to connect archaeological sites and beach resorts there. Construction started in 2020, but work on one section was put on pause this week on a judge's order pending an environmental review. The reason? That section runs through a jungle rich in ancient underground caves, and environmentalists warn those caves could be damaged by construction equipment. Gustavo Ampugnani is head of Greenpeace Mexico. Gustavo, a few months ago, activists from Greenpeace went to that section of the proposed Mayan Railroad and strapped themselves to construction equipment to stop it in its tracks. Tell me what you think that machinery is going to do to those caves.
The machinery is going to open up the forest that we have in what we call the track number 5 of the Mayan Train. And this is a very sensitive zone in the Yucatan Peninsula for two aspects. One is the well-conserved forest that we have where the machine is expected to keep working to complete this track. But also the other element of sensitiveness is the soil, karstic soil that we have in the Yucatan Peninsula under the ground. The soil is not only fragile, but under the soil we have a huge system of caves and underground rivers. And for us, it's extremely important that the federal authorities are very aware of that and do everything what is possible to protect this uniqueness of this environment.
These are kind of ancient caves where there's evidence of humans there from like a couple thousand years ago. Visualize it for us, how these caves work and their vastness.
It's very long in kilometers. We are talking about thousands of kilometers of interconnected underground rivers that create some natural wells that we call cenotes. And from the cenotes, underground goes to the Caribbean or the Mexican Caribbean Sea. So we are talking about miles and miles of rivers that are not well understood or discovered.
So these cenotes and this underground cave system, they're under this 41-mile stretch, that Section 5 you mentioned, of this railroad that's under construction. Now that construction has been halted there, do you feel like you've won a victory?
Well, I mean, we have to wait a little bit more because we know the government is going to reject this decision and they will present more information to back their work there. And also is pending a decision by the judges regarding the case that Greenpeace filed some weeks ago as well.
So Greenpeace filed its own legal order against this project?
Yes, after the protest that we did at the end of March, as you mentioned it at the beginning of the interview, we followed up this protest filing a case. Our case is because this work was started without doing the environmental impact assessment that every infrastructure project should do before starting building something.
Now, this Mayan train project, it was announced in 2018 by Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's known as AMLO. And it was a campaign promise he'd made. And he says the project has already generated 150,000 jobs. And he sees it as an environmentally friendly way to help develop tourism in southeastern Mexico. What's wrong with that idea?
I mean, the idea in general aspect is not bad from our point of view. We agree that this part of the country needs to have more connection between cities and villages. But this is a mega project. This project has several objectives. And what we fear is that this project, what is doing is articulating a lot of the predatory drivers of the environment. Because in the last 30 years, the biodiversity of the Yucatan Peninsula and the way of living, the traditional way of living of the indigenous communities that are in the Yucatan Peninsula has been affected by predatory tourism, real estate speculation, big farms, big agriculture or agribusiness. I mean, the purpose of the Tren Maya is not a public transportation project. It's a touristical project and is reproducing industrialized tourism for foreign persons who can pay a lot of money to stay in the Mexican Caribbean, coming from the US, coming from Canada, coming from Europe. So it's a predatory kind of tourism. And this project will make that worse. More important, the social implications of the Tren Maya. Because what we are seeing in the Yucatan Peninsula is the potential clash of two cultural views of how the territory needs to be used.
Gustavo Ampugnani is head of Greenpeace Mexico. He's been speaking to us from Mexico City. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Most taxi drivers around the world are men, but in Istanbul, more women are getting behind the wheel. This trend grew during the pandemic. The number of women cabbies is still relatively small, but they're finding acceptance on the city's congested roads. From Istanbul, reporter Fariba Nawa reports.
Şenay Küçükkap welcomes a passenger into her sparkling clean taxi and asks him where he's going. He tells her a shopping mall, and the two start chatting comfortably as Küçükkap pulls into traffic. There's nothing uncommon about this interaction except for one thing. It's the first time this passenger, a university student named Uğur, is riding with a woman taxi driver. Among 50,000 cabbies in Istanbul, only 15 are women, but that number is growing. With Turkey's economy suffering, unemployed women are turning to this tough job. It's good to see women working in every industry, Uğur tells Küçükkap, and I feel more secure with a woman driver because women tend to have more control. They follow the rules of the road more. Uğur is one of many passengers who offer support to Küçükkap as she ferries them across the city. Sometimes people act as if they saw an alien when they see me, she says. There are many women drivers in Istanbul now, but when they see a woman driving a taxi, they're so surprised. I've been doing this for a year and a half, and I enjoy it very much. So do my customers. Küçükkap steps on the gas with her platform-heeled sandals, toes neatly manicured. She wears a fashionable white sweater over skinny jeans adorned with pearls. She says the men taxi drivers expect her to wear sneakers and a cap, like them. If you're working in a male-dominated industry, people expect you to become masculine, she says. But I tell them that's not how it should be. Küçükkap worked in a corporate marketing job before the pandemic, but says being a cabbie is way more of an adventure than a desk job. I love communicating with people, she says. People stop and take notice when they see Küçükkap behind the wheel. When she's parked, a woman comes over to congratulate her for being brave enough to drive a taxi. Brave for two reasons. It can be dangerous, especially at night. Taxi drivers get robbed. But brave for another reason. Istanbul's taxi business is riddled with corruption. There aren't nearly enough licensed taxis to meet the city's demands. And who controls them is all about politics and patronage. Adam Coşkunyurak is the spokesman for the Istanbul Taxi Union. He says Istanbul definitely needs more taxis and reform in the industry. But the city says the taxi union is blocking reform because it benefits from the status quo. At issue is private versus public ownership of taxi medallions. As the city and the union battle, taxi customers suffer. Aggressive drivers are notorious for sexual harassment and overcharging. Just last year, customers filed more than 43,000 complaints against cabbies. That was a record. But cabbies say their job is incredibly stressful, with long hours and low fares. Küçük Kalp says she has the same issues. I work at least 15 hours a day, but I don't feel the time passing, she says. Küçük Kalp sees the bright side because she says she accepts that life is a struggle. At 49 years old, Küçük Kalp is the breadwinner in her family. Küçük Kalp is divorced from two husbands, one who used to beat her. She has two adult children. At her taxi station, Küçük Kalp crosses her legs, lights up a cigarette, and asks for tea from a colleague. She says she demands respect from the men in this job. Adam Çelik, her colleague, says he likes having Küçük Kalp around. The men are not so aggressive with each other when Ms. Şenay works with us, and the usual profanity we use has turned into polite Turkish, Çelik says. Küçük Kalp and several other women cabbies have created a WhatsApp group to motivate each other and recruit other women to join the industry.
Ben alkollü insanlarda aldım, denk gelince alıyorsunuz.
Küçük Kalp says she's only had one troubling ride with two drunk people who didn't pay. And she's genuinely surprised at the support she gets, not only from customers and her male colleagues, but her kids, who say they are proud of their mother for driving a taxi. For The World, Fariba Nawa in Istanbul.
Few treatments exist for people who have long COVID. In the UK alone, there's more than 1 million people with this condition. But a group of medical specialists and professional opera singers have been examining whether opera techniques can help one of the most debilitating symptoms, breathlessness. That story and others you might have missed are on our website, theworld.org. Residents in Shanghai were counting down the seconds till the stroke of midnight last night. It's not New Year's Eve, of course, but people celebrating in the streets as Shanghai's COVID lockdown ended. Traffic, pedestrians, and joggers reappeared on the streets of Shanghai after a strict 2-month lockdown. Shanghai's Communist Party Committee said it was a success and in a written statement thanked citizens for their, quote, support and contributions. Life in China's largest city is now slowly returning to normal. This is Shanghai resident Zhu Jia. He says he came out to the Huangpu River to witness the moment the city came out of lockdown. He said, I hope we will cherish life in the future and will not let the pandemic affect our lives again. However, life isn't back to normal for all of Shanghai's 25 million residents. About 500,000 people live in parts of the city still under lockdown. Since the start of the pandemic, China's zero COVID policy has faced scrutiny. Some see this partial reopening in Shanghai as a government response to the public backlash, an effort to show some flexibility. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Join us back here tomorrow.
Before we go, this is Marco, here to remind you that from now through June 30th, we're asking listeners to support our work. Thanks to your generosity, our journalism remains independent and accessible to all. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making your gift today at theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.